I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
Leinster could offer me $5 million a year, I wouldn't go.
It is Johnny Moe!
Robbie weekly.
Little reverse pass. Drive
to Ireland! Magic!
Hello and welcome to Rugby Weekly Extra. Gavin Casey here, subbing in for Owen Toolan. Murray Kinsella has reversed his role. You'll be delighted to hear. And we're going to look back on all the rugby action from the weekend. Murray, first and foremost, how are you?
Great, Gav. Nice to chat about some really interesting games in the end. I wasn't massively looking forward to that weekend of rugby, to be honest, beyond the Ireland match. But the two interprovincial games turned out to be really lively in different ways, so there's loads to discuss.
There really is. Now, we do have to give a nod to our esteemed colleague Owen. His season came to an end with the Kintetsu Liners at the hands of the Wild Knights. Heavy enough scoreline in the end. Owen is unavailable because they have like a week of coaching reviews, and then I think he's going to be unavailable next week as he flies back to Australia. We have to leave him get his house in order, basically, over the next couple of weeks, and we're looking forward to catching up with him. But just a quick synopsis on their season. It seemed to go really well for them, and certainly for the Kintetsu Liners, the future seems bright. We knew it would be bright when Mr. Toolan was involved, to be fair.
Yeah. Well, winning that first kind of the first game against the top league team to get into this clash with Panasonic was an achievement, and that was seen probably as a success. They were, realistically, this would have been a massive upset if they beat Panasonic. As we mentioned, they've won the top league 5 times, littered with stars, big budget. And that obviously told in the second half. It was actually 7-7 at half time. I remember checking in. It was early in the morning Irish time. My puppy had woken me up. So I was up and saw the scoreline. Okay, that's very interesting. But by the final whistle, they pulled well clear, as you mentioned. And that was to be expected. I was chatting to Owen and I actually saw a few of the clips, and there was certainly some unbelievably questionable refereeing calls in amongst it. I think that seems to be a trend in Japan where the favourites massively get favoured by the referee. But there'll probably be a feeling anyway that Panasonic strength was going to pull through. So yeah, a disappointing end, I suppose. I'll be probably expecting that game. And it'll be interesting to see what happens next. I suppose looking forward, Japan's obviously restructuring, going to professional league, and there's massive development in that side of the game. But for now, Owen definitely deserves a bit of a breather, and class for him to get home after such a long time, obviously with all the restrictions and everything. So yeah, he deserves his break from listening to us natter away for a couple of weeks.
He certainly does. I hope he gets a few asahis in over the next few days, and we'll catch up with him again on the flip side. I'm looking forward to it already. Another season coming to an end, Murray, was the Ireland women's team. They kind of drew a line under their Six Nations, if you like. Probably in the end, on paper, looking at the table or looking at their third place finish, performed to par. They put away Italy fairly comprehensively in what wasn't a great game necessarily. But for Adam Griggs and co, it probably feels like a case of job done. Do you disagree with that in any way, or was it just a sort of a reasonable enough performance and result?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of 2 wins out of 3, it would have been what they were targeting. They spoke about that post-match, and definitely is a positive outcome. That was our kind of aim for them, wasn't it, in our preview pod, to be the best of the rest. And they were clearly enough that in the end. You know, it's a good win over Italy. They obviously hammered Wales. So there's obviously still a step to make up to the top two teams. And that's a worry, as we've discussed. But this was a decent way to finish. As you say, it was scrappy at times. The error count was high. 19 turnovers conceded by Italy and 12 by Ireland. So there was a lot of exchange of possession or short sequences of ball in play due to that. But there was loads of nice stuff in there from Ireland. Stacey Flood obviously was player of the match. I thought it was just a really brilliant, varied performance from her, who, like, she's been one of the real finds of this. You know, 2 really impressive appearances off the bench earned her that 10 jersey for this game. And I thought she took her chance wonderfully. Her kicking game, that was a weakness against France, we'd mentioned. They only kicked 11 times and there wasn't enough of that in their game. It was clearly something they'd focused on. And from early in the game, you saw that. I think in the 3rd minute, Flood has this long kick down the left-hand side and she finds grass. And Italy are pinned into their 22. They were insistent on running the ball out, as they always are. I think it's really naive at times from them, albeit they can get some success from it at times. But in that instance, the pressure eventually ends up being the try for Dorothy Wall. Now, there's a couple of missed chances from Ireland on 5-metre chances in between, but that long kick actually leads to the sequence of pressure, and Ireland in the end take their chance really well. It's the quick tap from Stacey Flood, which we've seen from her already in this championship, just identifying a chance for Dorothy Wall, who, it has to be said, has shown great work rate to kind of reload out onto the left edge. She'd made a carry just a phase before off the maul infield. Really strong carry, and she's back on her feet, gets a one-on-one against the Italy scrum half and takes her chance. I thought Flood's defence was good as well. She's clearly a jackal thread as well. Two more in this game, and she had a turnover in each of the games before. And then her passing range is really nice to watch. She can get such width and speed on the ball. Honestly, I think she's one of the best passers in the Six Nations already. She really puts the ball out in front of carriers. She's really clever at sending them into the right space. And there's a nice variety there as well. You saw her with the rugby league end-over-end passes at times as well. So even a short little ball off her left shoulder at one stage. So yeah, I like that variety. There were errors in there, absolutely. And it's funny because after the Wales game, we were talking about Hannah Tyrrell. Okay, it looks like they've found their 10, but Flood has really put her hand up in that regard. And then you saw Amy Lee Murphy-Crowe probably giving a demonstration of what she's capable of in 15s as well. Another 7-star, obviously, and got a couple of chances. I thought her first try was really nice where, again, Dorothy Wall breaks off the maul. It was a play they used twice against Wales, and Parsons got really good gains off it. Wall draws in the number 8, the tail gunner, and Murphy-Crowe goes into the seam at the back of the line out. You see that really nice ball transfer. She gets it into her left hand and she's able to fend with her right twice, which is actually something that Bavin Parsons needs to work on. She's got into a habit of fending with just one side, and that's obviously a bit of a technical skill, but Murphy-Crowe has really good skills developed and honed in the sevens. Her pace obviously for the final score as well. Where there was a lovely wide pass from Laura Feely, the prop off the bench, where taking advantage of turnover possession. So those bits were great. Cliona Maloney obviously got a nice try as well with the quick tap and barreling over, no nonsense. And yeah, they'll be pleased with elements of it. It was, as you say, scrappy. I thought their breakdown was better. Their physicality was good as well. The front row probably led that in particular, and made some big dominant tackles, and obviously some jackling there as well, as you always get with this side. The line-out was scrappy on both sides, and that didn't help with the flow of the game, but there was loads of good bits in there, and for Ireland now, hopefully we'll get an announcement and scheduling around the World Cup qualifiers, but they're in a pretty decent place heading into that competition, I think, with a psychological edge clearly over the teams they're going to face.
We saw a tweet from Adam Griggs afterwards, which was quite defiant, I guess. He'd had a difficult week. We had probably criticised him, although I don't think we criticised his coaching ability or indeed really the players. It was more so an administrative error or a kind of a gap in his administrative knowledge that we took umbrage with during the week with Bernard on last week's Thursday pod. And I'm not arrogant enough to suggest he was just responding to us. I think he was under the cosh, generally speaking, and probably felt he was getting it from all sides. And his tweet was kind of along the lines of, I guess, returning fire, criticising experts and saying Ireland were basically on the right track. I think he described it as a private success, and it very much might feel like that within that squad. But I guess just the fact that, say, they beat, like they did exactly what was expected of them in this championship, and it's going to be so difficult for them to exceed that in the next couple of years. Private success is okay. Like if these players and this squad feels like they're on a journey and they're getting somewhere, that's great. But I guess my question is, where are they going? Like how far can they go when there is kind of this, it's not a ceiling on them necessarily, it's just a very obvious gap between them and the two finalists, for example, in this year's championship.
I certainly think they can close that gap, not fully, but even in that game, as we discussed afterwards, Gav, we kind of picked apart the bits they got wrong, and I'm not saying they would have won or even really been very competitive, but it certainly wouldn't have been a 50-point blowout for the French. Like all the issues we discussed last week on the Thursday pod, I think are still really relevant. This game doesn't gloss over that kind of stuff, and those questions, which, you know, it's not worth getting into all over again, but they're definitely still there, still to be answered, and the game needs to work hard to catch up on France and England, because as we've described, they're going to keep getting better. they're going to keep improving with the programs they have in place, with the ambition in the country and the backing from their unions. And Ireland need to match that if they're going to keep pace. So yeah, while it is a positive end, and as you say, private success is great, and that's obviously a team in this group, and that's important, and it's really good that you can harness things on the outside. Like, it's the standard trope for sports, isn't it? We got written off and now we proved everyone wrong. I don't really think that was the case with this game. I think people probably expected them to win against Italy, but that's how it works in sports teams. We've all been there and we've all harnessed that energy. But yeah, the wider questions are still there, and let's hope it doesn't just, like, and let's put ourselves under pressure that it doesn't just fade away now. We don't talk about women's rugby for a long, long time. The women's AIL is due to come back, obviously, for the start of next season. We saw the RFU's plan for club rugby, and you know, there's tweaks to the league there. So fingers crossed that that's really competitive and gives us plenty to discuss in a positive light, seeing players develop, and that when they come to that qualifier, I think they should be in confident form facing, you know, Italy and Scotland. That's where they are at the moment. They're above them, and they need to work hard to catch the others.
One last one on this before we chat Rainbow Cup, and it was a message we got in the group, in the WhatsApp group, from Robin Dempsey. And Robin was saying, I think that, this is lengthy, so bear with me, I think that introducing professionalism now would not address the deeper issues in the women's game in Ireland and could actually do damage by only focusing on the short term. Making the top 30 or so players professional would be like putting the roof on your house before digging the foundations or building the walls. The AIL and the levels below need serious support in coaching and administration in order to produce talent. The only existing development pathways are through interprovincial sides, brackets, which have not been given much attention by the powers that be, or the sevens, brackets, which has been given a huge focus because it gives the most bang for your buck. I think the RFU need to invest some time in creating a development structure that would utilise third level institutions in the pathway. This would bridge the gap between underage and senior structures and might also be a great place to pick up players from other sports. It could take the place of the school system in men's rugby as the primary pathway. It also allows for regional development centres and doesn't rely on all the players having to move to Dublin. All the third level institutions should be partnered with clubs in order to get players to stay in the game after finishing their education, and this would strengthen the AIL. So my question really for you, Murray, is why isn't Robin Dempsey running the IRFU?
Yeah, that's a great message. Really sensible points. And absolutely harnessing the third level is key, as well as the AIL. Like, it's so different. And the men's and women's games are different. The interprovincials are great, but it happens for like 3 weeks. It's not, you know, you playing for your province is not the development tool. Yes, you're exposed to high-level competition, but in women's rugby, the AIL is where you play for the entire season. And that's where, for me, as well as in tandem with obviously improving the pipeline and the number of players coming through, I think those clubs need just a little bit more support. And it's not a lot. I was speaking to someone last week. Their club is ready to have what you describe as an academy, you know, really professional level coaching, really good S&C. And to an extent, obviously, the clubs are already doing that and deserve credit for that. But with a little bit more investment and resource and recognition and engagement from the top of the RFU, I think that can be even better. And then you've got a season-long program for all those players so that when they come into Ireland camp, it's not as great a step up. You know, the Interpros are brilliant for those few weeks. It's obviously a level up because you've got all the best players competing against each other there. But I think the AIL can be that over the course of a season.
We'll continue on this theme of Interpros then. I want to start with Ulster Connacht, because first and foremost, we need to give Connacht their dues. We probably all believed, at least three of us on Thursday's pod, that Ulster were going to win that game by maybe 10 to 15. I think purely because they had more match practice and they were in that sort of vein of competition, whereas Connacht weren't. And yet, in a really enthralling game, Connacht produced the goods and use some of those new law trials to their benefit as well at the end. I mean, that was what decided the game, but just give us your overall impression of it and maybe begin by telling us how surprised, if it is a fair way of putting it, you were that Connacht won the game.
It was really, really an excellent win. And when Ulster went to 17-7, that was what, 47 minutes in, just after halftime, you think, oh, they've got that crucial blow in those championship minutes. And Carty's been yellow carded. You think this is kind of pushing towards game, set, match, but Connacht responded brilliantly. You have to give Abraham Papali'i massive credit for the impact he made on the game. It was remarkable, really. It was an individual tour de force from him, showing exactly what he can bring. He looks in the best nick he has been in. And I know Birch was excited when he ran on the pitch. He was right to be. His first carry, he just smashes over the top of Burns. There are 14 men here. Cardi's still in the bin. He drags two more defenders into the tackle. And Blade makes a brilliant decision, taking advantage of the kind of hold-fold confusion from Ulster on the right fringe of the ruck. And what an outstanding finish. Tom Daly stepping up and converting. And they're right back in it all of a sudden, you know. And he just kept carrying hard and kept making big impacts. Obviously, the game kind of seesaws there, but they finished right over the top. So much energy, so much clarity around it as well. I think the captain's challenge was a great example of that. It was just so calm and precise from Owen Masterson, while Kieran Marmion was going absolutely mental. Calms him down and gives really clear instruction. Even asked for the yellow card, which I thought was a justified query after the challenge itself. And then they take their chance. Listen, the bounce was deeply unfortunate for Will Addison, but Connacht had got into a position to give themselves that little bit of luck. I think they'd earned it, really. A lovely kick from Fitzgerald, who again had an impact. Their whole bench did. And Sullivan, another sub, finishing off just about before the dead ball line. So it was a wonderful comeback in that sense. And again, like, how many times have we talked about it and how enjoyable it is to watch Connacht with that kind of form? They were outstanding when they got that kind of attacking flow. Blade was obviously behind and prominent in so much of it. He's just such a dangerous... It's his acceleration off the mark is just lightning quick, and he can be so difficult to defend when you haven't got perfect set around the ruck. He's really clinical and ruthless and taking advantage of that. So yeah, there were some really prominent individual influences in terms of getting back on top.
Can I put you on the spot here and ask you about Blade in relation to, I guess, having an international career at all? Do you look at him and his form, which I feel like we speak about so regularly now, and think, first and foremost, that he's hugely unfortunate to not be involved in Andy Farrell's Ireland setup at the moment, or at least he hasn't been getting any game time. And secondly, like, that he should be actually in there at the expense of even, say, Craig Casey, who is a super player, before people email me in anger and angst, and will have many, many years, I'm sure, in an Ireland jersey. But just when you look at, say, how often Blade is playing for Connacht, how well he tends to play, that maybe... Okay, it's good to plan for the future, but what about the right now when you've got this excellent player at your disposal?
Yeah, it's just so difficult because of the competition there, and you've mentioned a few of the guys. And I mean, you can ask the exact same question about John Cooney, who has often had very similar strengths. He's an amazing attacking player who makes consistent clean line breaks, who kicks goals as well and does all this. And there's absolutely no doubting Caelan Blade, and I don't want to get into kind of diminishing his game because I don't think it warrants that. There's just guys ahead of him who the head coach at the moment, he prefers their skill sets. I mean, he brings a lot of what Jamison Gibson-Park brings around the ruck. He's probably even quicker, although Gibson-Park is pretty lively. Obviously, Conor Murray is different to the other scrum halves and has very different clear strengths that, as we know and as we've seen repeatedly, are more important to the people who are picking test rugby teams. They may not be to us, but they are to those who are in those situations where they've got to try and win those kind of incredibly tense battles where there probably aren't those same holes around the fringe. There aren't those same slips that players can exploit. And then therefore your strengths are slightly less relevant. So yeah, it's unfortunate for him basically that there are so many good nines. Kieran Marmion's an excellent scrum half, and they've kind of seesawed in Connacht, and there's not really clearly a number one there either. So that doesn't help with Ireland selection either. But what a brilliant player for Connacht to have, and a guy who cares so deeply about playing for the province and has become a leader for them as well. And again, he was outstanding in this game. The other interesting one was the double movement one. And I thought there, and Paul Marshall, in fairness, he was on the commentary on the game I watched. He said, why didn't they use the captain's challenge there and have a look at it? It was a really tough one to call, I think, because yeah, there's a little bit of roll there, but there's a momentum. He's not been clearly held, and he does stretch out. I really think that decision could have gone either way, and a captain's challenge would have made it a very tricky spot for Andrew Brace. It would have been a really tricky decision, but he was just a lot lively. That was another example. It was a lovely Connacht set piece attack where they use the hooker off the touchline. Paul Boyle runs an excellent line just outside, and he gets the offload away to Blade, who's always running hard, and he will continue to do so. Whether he gets back in the Ireland mix, I don't know, because there's so much competition there.
Yeah, no, to be fair, 5 or 6 into 3 just doesn't go. It just feels with Blade, unfortunate to me, I guess, that he doesn't have that to his name at the moment, you know, like, and I hope he does, even if he never quite breaks into sort of starting territory, which he very well might do. I do hope he gets that recognition, at least, of being an excellent player down the line. From Ulster's point of view, in fairness, they have their eyes on a bigger prize, I think it's reasonable to say. I don't think that's necessarily, though, an excuse as to how the game got away from them. They'll be disappointed, particularly, as you say, when they score that rollover try from the line-out. I think it's their 17th try from Amal this season. It did feel like a moment in a game, like a crucial juncture at which they were turning the screw that little bit and exerting their control over Connaughton. For them to relinquish a 10-point lead, but I guess the manner in which it happened, albeit with that little bit of extra fortune at the end with that bounce, Dan McFarland will be looking at it in disappointment, I guess, and I'm wondering how it actually went wrong from their point of view.
Yeah, they did. They let errors and poor decisions really creep into their game. And there's probably a sequence late on from around 65 minutes onwards where they make a number of errors. Alan O'Connor drops the ball in midfield at one stage where Papali's putting on massive line speed. And that was the time where Shane Delahunt comes in with the massive celebrations that Ulster weren't too happy about. Soon enough after that, they have a line out on the left-hand side, and they force the ball out to the right edge. It's not great possession. And Sullivan makes a really good low tackle on Addison, who knocks on the ball as he attempts that kind of double carry back up on his feet. And then very soon after that, they have a huge mischance, really. You think of Addison coming back on the kick return, which was such a nice moment for him. He kind of glides to the outside. He recognises that Delahunt's there. He has that little goose step that he uses so well. And he links to Balakoon. A lovely bit of play from him. But Balakoon absolutely has to hit Michael Leary outside him. It's a straight run in for a try. It's a guaranteed score. And that was in the 71st minute. It would have put them back in front. But it was a chain of errors that they'll feel were very avoidable. And that's, I suppose, where they slipped. There were loads of good bits in their performance as well. And if they had got back on top of that stage, you would have said it was a justified win. I thought, again, they had some really good, outstanding individual performances. Nick Timoney continues to impress for me. He's just been excellent, hasn't he, since could see his news of departure, even before that with injuries as well. He's really stepped up. He's winning jackal turnover penalties, making line breaks. Obviously, he had that loose offload on the end of one of them where, again, they miss a really good try-scoring chance, but it was an excellent break. He beat defenders all day, really. So yeah, they've lots of good bits in there, but they'll be frustrated with the way they backed up error after error after error in the second half. And Connacht were able to get on top of that and take advantage of it.
You mentioned him earlier, and I wanted to ask you a little bit more about Abraham Papali'i. It does feel like very recently we were having a conversation again on the Thursday pod about whether or not he was the answer to that question and at aid for Connacht, and whether or not, for example, Andy Friend would consider moving on from him at some point, just in the sense that it hadn't gone particularly well for him, a couple of red cards and just various cases of misfortune, really, and probably in the cases of the red cards, you could argue stupidity. But I don't know. Sometimes there comes a point where you nearly have to accept that it's not going to click for a player at a province. I got the impression from Bernard, for example, that maybe he thought that moment was coming for Papali'i, where it wasn't going to necessarily click for him, and then he comes on and produces this performance. If they can keep him at that sort of level of fitness and get him into or sustain that level of form, he's going to be an absolute weapon for them. I know I'm stating the obvious, but probably even more so than we had anticipated when he signed.
But like, the obvious is good. You know, he came on, he played half an hour, and he was the top ball carrier in the game. Like, that is everyone can see that, but it's very hard to stop it. And fair play to Will Addison. I know he had his head probably on the wrong side, but he did manage to stop him on that little sneak over the top of the ruck, because you just don't want that massive human being thundering at you. And the rest of them on the pitch are massive human beings. They're all big guys, but he is another level, and he has that power and the aggression. There was a lovely moment where they get a 5 meter penalty, and Blades kind of standing there looking around, what are we going to do here? Masterson grabs the ball off him and hands it to Papa Lee's. There's only one decision here, and he taps it, and away he goes. And yeah, he had those red cards, and it was really kind of uncertain how it was going to work out for him, because it was such a disastrous start with suspension and missing so much rugby. And he's worked very hard by all accounts. And Andy Friend said it after the match, technically and making sure that he's a little bit lower. Now, obviously, there was the moment in this game where it's challenged, the tackle on Matty Ray, which I agree with Andy Friend. I thought it was actually poor form. Matty Ray knows he hasn't been hit on the head there, you know. Listen, sorry, I actually shouldn't say that, because I don't know. I wasn't in his shoes. Maybe he thinks it has glanced. But for me, it was a legit tackle. It was a really dominant hit. And I can understand, certainly, the Connacht frustration. They'll feel, oh, that's them targeting a player and trying to add to his reputation in that regard, when he's been working hard, and they've seen him behind the scenes, how much he's probably suffered early on in his time and trying to settle in, and things aren't going well. But yeah, we saw half an hour of what he can do. And even if you're using him in that role, it's unbelievably important. As I say, he was probably the big factor in Connacht finishing so strongly. And he's such a weapon. There's a bit of chat around a couple of French clubs having a look, and there's interest out there because he's such a big carrier and such a big guy. And there's definitely a fondness, I think, in the Connacht squad there. So fascinated to see what happens next. But like, if he keeps performing in that way, there's no way you can let him go.
No, no way. And I'm telling you, Mac Hansen is going to be a sensation for Connacht. It just happens under Andy Friend. Yeah. I know you poured cold water on it last week. Well, no, you were diluting my excitement on Connacht's behalf, but I swear Andy Friend just has that little bit of magic touch, I think.
He really does. Like, and Ben O'Donnell, who we're starting to see more of, maybe he hasn't got that bit of space to go through quite yet, but it is clearly a really good player, and most of the signings have worked out that way. Even the ones who've taken it, or who've been there for a couple of years, like Tom Daly, I thought was really good in this game again, and is consistently brilliant this season. He had some, like, he slotted his shots off the tee. He had some excellent bits of defence. He always carries aggressively. He's an intelligent rugby player. Works really hard. And every kind of example like that just adds to the reputation, I suppose, of Friend as a guy who can go out, get really good value. And his ability to connect with people definitely helps in that. He's good at understanding where people are coming from, I think, and where they were in their career, and how you can just have such a massive shift in mindset with a few words to encourage a player, or say, listen, we want to bring you here and let you fulfill your potential. So yeah, Mac Hansen's 23, and I wasn't trying to write him off by any means, so sorry if it came across that way.
No, not at all. But it's a valid point you make, and about, say, Friend's ability to identify, he has a means of communication with people that seems to bring the best out of them. And I go back to even when Papa Lee originally signed, I was speaking to somebody who, now this was secondhand information, but speaking to somebody who would have known him in New Zealand, and they were saying, like, it's a little bit of a lucky dip. You could get a good player, but we kind of haven't seen the evidence of that, and maybe work rate and training and things like that were called into question. And he actually, the person I was speaking with, didn't really believe that Papa Lee would be able to make that step up, say, to European level. But clearly Friend identifies something in a player, something probably intrinsic that maybe to the naked eye is invisible, and thinks he can build upon that kind of raw material or the raw ingredients of it. That's an unbelievable quality for a coach, particularly a coach working with a smaller budget than, say, the other three provinces at the moment.
Yeah, definitely. It's his real strength. He's a kind of people person, for want of a better phrase, and is so good at engaging people in the right way, and I think maximizing their potential. You look across the team, and like, it is a weird one. We always talk about identity probably around Munster as much as anyone, and loads of the Connacht team aren't sorry, quite a few of them aren't from Connacht, but have made it a home. Like someone like Tom Daly, who's so loyal to the province now, and a whole host of other guys. Gavin Thornbury playing the rugby of his career, having left the system, gone to New Zealand and being brought back in by Connacht, and now he's thriving there. And there's examples across the team. So that's brilliant. At the same time, great to see them have Sean O'Brien coming out of the academy now as well, and they've promoted guys out of their academy. Niall Murray, I thought, looked good when he came on and has added a few kg. Clearly, he looks like a different athlete. Very exciting young second row, homegrown, and that's brilliant for the province as well. O'Brien's been excellent at outside centre. Looks to have a real range of skills and a lot of confidence as well. So even when they're getting players now through from the academy, Friend is obviously good at giving them opportunity and getting them in the right mindset to take it. So it is exciting. And as we always say with Connacht, it's just about being consistent. Let's see a similar performance next time, and we'll know they're pushing towards competing with the likes of Leinster, Ulster for titles.
Let's chat Leinster, Munster then. I got the impression from a lot of people afterwards, firstly, Munster fans were relieved at having won at the RDS. I understand that. But maybe they were adding an extra significance, going a little bit OTT as to the actual significance of a victory. Okay, they got the monkey off their back, so to speak, but it was a baby monkey, you know. I don't really understand that metaphor, I should stress, but it did feel like a performance that was to par and a victory that should have been absolutely expected, even by that margin, when you looked at the two team sheets, in my opinion at least. I'm wondering what yours is.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very fair, I think. And again, I don't want to diminish Munster's win because it was really good. They played really well and they were really aggressive. Their breakdown accuracy in particular was outstanding. Some of the tries they scored were excellent. Obviously, the first one being the clear highlight, a brilliant score. But you do factor in, obviously, Leinster's team selection, the fact that Harry Byrne went off after 5 minutes, and then David Hawkshaw, who wasn't even meant to be on the bench, having replaced Kieran Frawley, comes on. And the 9-10 struggled quite badly for Leinster, I thought, if I'm being honest. They made errors and they made some bad decisions and gave Munster ins that way. Obviously, Caelan Dorris had dropped out before the game as well, so the back row gets a rejig as well. So Munster are absolutely realistic. I don't think, like afterwards, I don't think there was any sense of kind of gloating or saying, look at us, we proved everyone wrong, which I think was really good. And obviously, you'll get that online as well, and that's part of the fun. Like, I think if a team's fans can't enjoy their team winning, then what the hell is the point? But everyone, I think, is pretty realistic about where it is. If we get to see them play each other again in another final, then that'll be the real litmus test. But it does help. It does help. I know it's only, you know, a Rainbow Cup game against a weakened Leinster team, but they have beaten them, and they've beaten them in the RDS, and that would have been really satisfying. You could see even at the end, obviously with the last captain's challenge, they wanted to keep playing on and get that bonus point and really drive it home. So there's loads of good bits in there that they should enjoy and push forward with, while having that realism that you've kind of summed up well there.
Yeah, and I think, as you put it so well, the enjoyment and like the embracing of a victory like this by supporters is totally understandable, completely natural. I felt it myself as somebody who is openly a Munster fan. I think so. I would have doubts as to the real significance of the victory from a psychological standpoint. Going up to Dublin and winning, great, but as you mentioned yourself, even in the aftermath, it didn't feel as though Munster were going overboard on it themselves. It felt, actually, they gave off the impression that it was a game they felt they should win, and they won. Then I guess, to reverse my own argument a little bit, it shows them at least that, and this sounds incredibly obvious, but when they are better than Leinster on a given day, that they can win a game. And that's actually something that, first and foremost, they haven't really been able to prove to themselves in terms of being better than Leinster at all in recent games, apart from one at Thomond Park, where they probably were better. They controlled most of the game, and Leinster stung them at the end, and that would have been a massive psychological blow. So if you're looking at this in terms of being a ladder, I would say a win in Dublin is probably like a rung up the ladder, if not scaling to the top of it.
And some of the circumstances in which they push themselves towards victory are as encouraging as anything. The first try is obviously a brilliant example of that. Leinster have kind of missed an early chance in the 22, which you think is really unlike them. And I actually thought Stephen Archer had changed his mind in that maul where he wraps up Dan Sheehan, and that became relevant later in the game, obviously, with Scott Fardy and a captain's challenge. But they missed their chance, and then Munster earned a turnover through Peter Romani, who was really excellent in this game, clearly very motivated for it, and he forces the error from Hugh O'Sullivan. And it's a brilliant turnover attack. We saw bits of this against Toulouse in that game where Munster obviously lost as well, but it is something that they've evidently been focusing on improving because it hasn't really been a strength for them. Byrne moves the ball, Carberry puts it into Damian D'Allende's hands, and he makes a brilliant decision. What you get in turnover situations is a chance to kind of pick on some of the forwards in the defensive line. In this case, he steps inside Penny and he beats Andrew Porter on the outside. And then I think he does really well in behind, where Jordan Larmour is kind of closing up on him while being worried about the threat wide to the right of D'Allende. And he kind of shimmies to the right-hand side. Larmour turns his back and then bang, he's gone to the left. Really clever pass as well in the end, because Josh Murphy's in that passing channel to Conor Murray, who's running the inside support line, but he just keeps the ball low. Josh Murphy goes to kind of block up high and he gets it underneath. It was a lovely bit of skill from a guy who had a brilliant game as well. So that was excellent. I thought the build-up to Murray's second try as well, really impressive. They strike off the left-hand side scrum, which comes from a bit of that naivety from Leinster. I think they were trying to run it out of their 22 and they had a few moments like that. Not that they don't sometimes do that, but I think when they do it well, there's a very clear picture there of that being the best option. They knock it on the edge in this instance, and Munster use a simple enough play with Carberry looping behind D'Allende, Daly loaded on the inside of D'Allende, and he gets a chance to go 1-on-1. He sits down Tommy O'Brien and then goes through Hawkshaw. Really good gain line for the first phase. They go back to Lachman. He actually ends up with slow ball there, but O'Mahony does a brilliant job on the next phase of carrying off 9 and getting a really good long ball presentation to allow quick ball, even though it's not a really dominant carry. And then, speaking of dominant carries, on comes Gavin Coombs, and he picks out the halfbacks, runs at O'Sullivan, kind of pirouettes, and Hawkshaw's attracted in, and a brilliant offload. Great to see that skill set from him. Again, we saw glimpses of it in the Toulouse game, and he's just going to get better and better all the time when he's adding strings to his bow like that. He puts Chris Farrell away, and a really nice clear out on Michael Bent by two of the Munster forwards. I think Archer's in there, and Murray makes a good decision. He kind of tricks Sean Cronin with his eyes. He's not sure which of the fringes to cover, and he snipes home. That was excellent attack again. And the last one was the maul penalty try. Really interesting one because, you know, Haley's at the front of the line out with D'Allende, and Tadhg Byrne's late in into the line out, and Scott Fardy's very frustrated afterwards. You can hear him kind of remonstrating with the referee, saying they had two halves, i.e. two receivers, rather than Byrne being fully in the line out. It really was marginal, and you think you probably see it in a lot of line outs, but they don't end up with more penalty tries. But Haley goes up and Byrne's just slightly staggered off him, and he transfers the ball down. Really nice skills from the fullback in the line out, and a good lift from D'Allende. And then Chris Farrell is the receiver, and it's actually his power in the maul that's really important in getting them that drive up the right-hand edge of the maul. And Cormac Foley it is in that instance who pulls a couple of Munster players out and collapses it. So excellently constructed, clever line-out play from Munster. So loads of good bits like that in attack, and the breakdown, as always, when they win, the breakdown is always a prominent feature. They're so ferocious there. Several Jackal threats, but also the counter-rucking. And I know Jack O'Donoghue got penalised at one stage, but on the whole, the counter-rucking was just superb again. They obviously spend a lot of time on it. It harnesses the kind of aggression a lot of their players have, and it just made life kind of miserable for Leinster in attack. So all those aspects were really excellent.
What did you make of that captain's challenge at the end and the kind of conundrum that we found ourselves in as to whether or not a maul after a line out is a set piece? The answer to that question, by the way, is that it's not, but within the spirit of the law, or within the, I don't know, within, I guess it would be consensus in a game, say if you're preparing for a game as a coach, like that the maul is kind of part of a set piece. It's just technically not. So it's a dilemma, isn't it? Like it exposed a fairly obvious flaw in this law trial from the get-go.
two really interesting examples. And I know the game's already decided, so arguably they're meaningless, but I can tell you and I can guarantee to anyone who's had a conversation with their friends about this, every rugby club involved in this comp and elsewhere is going to have discussed this. I know that for a fact over the last couple of days, and trying to figure out what they can and can't challenge, because it's clearly going to become massively important. As we said in the Connacht game, like them getting that challenge right where Lowry strips the ball away from Marmy and obviously it becomes a penalty and they kick into the corner and win. It shows just how important they can be. Let me just get to the second Munster challenge first. That's the last one, right at the end. And I actually thought it was poor enough form from the players. I'd imagine there's been a bit of dialogue since to kind of apologise, because I thought it was out of hand the way they were going at the referee. It was just unseemly towards the end of the match and was very confusing, I think, for people at home. Like, what is going on here? In that instance, I don't think they had any grounds. You know, they're talking about a side entry a few phases before. And that was a non-decision. And players can't actually challenge a non-decision where the referee essentially just misses a technical infringement around the breakdown. So I think all parties have agreed that was not a thing they could have challenged. And Munster players got that one wrong. The first one, I think they were within their rights to challenge that. It's very confusing, to be honest. And that's why every team is looking at this. I'm looking at the documents that were sent around, and there's all sorts of sub-clauses and clauses and contradictory things. You know, you're able to challenge foul play. So for me, in that instance, it's foul play by Scott Fardy. You know, you're not, like, being offside in the maul and also collapsing the maul, which he does by changing his bind, for me, that's foul play. So you can actually challenge foul play, obviously. That's the second of the three scenarios. One is a try scored situation. The second is foul play. And then any decision in the last 5 minutes. As you said, set piece decisions aren't part of that. So if a ref gives a scrum penalty where he feels the prop has lost his bind, you can't challenge that. Or someone making a contact in the air at a line out, that's a decision by the referee at set piece. You can't challenge that. But as you say, the play has rolled on there. And I can kind of understand where the referee was coming from in terms of it's a non-decision. So he's seen Scott Fardy make that move and he's decided, let's play on here. And then Munster knock it on. So he's thinking that's a non-decision. And he's thinking it's around a set piece as well. So like the referees are probably getting used to it as well. But in that instance, I think Munster should have been allowed a challenge. And I think Peter Manning probably think, okay, I need to be a bit more specific even next time. So if he says that's foul play, you know, the second scenario on your list of scenarios that you sent us out is that we can challenge foul play. And that's what that was. So it just adds another layer of complexity even for the referees. I think it was great in the Connacht Ulster match, but in this match it was like really messy and confusing. And I think most people coming away are going to go, what can you actually challenge and not challenge? So yeah, I'm still unconvinced that it's the right way to go forward with the game, but I'm sure we'll see other good examples like the Connacht one.
Yeah, definitely. It is a work in progress for all parties as well, as you say. For the referee in that instance, for Peter Romani, there seemed to be confusion on both sides. I know, to be fair, on behalf of the officials, they probably have to act quite concretely and quite certain, but I just didn't get the impression that they were, like, you know. And I have to say, I completely agree with you in terms of the Munster players' conduct towards the end, without putting too fine a point in it. Just don't be at that bollocks, you know what I mean? I think it's just poor enough. Like, it's optically bad. I know that's a bit of a buzzword, like, but it just doesn't. We've had plenty of conversations where we've actually criticised officials for treating players like children and almost dealing with them with contempt, and how that even sends the wrong message, generally speaking, and winds players up. But I felt that reaction from the Munster players was uncalled for, particularly at when the game was over. Like, just get over it. Like, you know,
when you look at them going for a bonus point, and that's what they were saying afterwards, you can understand that. And they're massively, like, hyped up. It was such an edgy game. There was so much edge to it, which obviously in certain instances, like Archer's yellow card, you don't want to see that. But I think everyone who watches rugby enjoys the bit of push and shove and people sorting each other out and that kind of thing. That's part of the game. And obviously the referees don't enjoy it, but players, they are on an edge and it's hard for them to control their emotions, but they probably got that one wrong and they'll put their hand up and admit that. So yeah, it adds another layer of intrigue to things. We saw the other one of the other trial laws with the goal line restarts in both games, actually, when the ball was kicked into the in-goal area. I thought it was interesting to see both restarts were taken way off to the side of the posts rather than underneath the posts, which all the Aussie teams seem to think was the case. And in the Ulster instance, where they get the ball back, you see they've already set up Nick Timoney to play off the kind of receiver. So I can't remember who catches it, but they hit Nick Timoney building up speed, and he's going back at the defence at absolute pace. And this is one of the concerns World Rugby have, unintended consequences, they call it, where you get big guys coming at real pace with a massive run-up. He picks out Blade, I think, in that instance. And listen, it was the collision, obviously, probably hurt for the players involved, but it wasn't really dangerous one. You've seen in Australia a couple of times, the Rebels actually use one of their big tight head props, and he just thunders at people, and it looks kind of jarring. Munster's instance, CJ Sander actually he catches it, and he passes the ball to Carberry, who links on to Diolende, who makes good ground off it, actually. And you're thinking, oh, this could be a promising situation. But it's probably one to watch as well, just in terms of those big collisions on the end of a restart. We didn't see the red card one, fortunately, but I think we're both agreed, Gav, on that, about players coming back, a different player coming back on after 20 minutes is totally at odds with what we're seeing around head injury in the game. And even one of the red cards recently in New Zealand, it was Alex Hodgman for the Blues, just a really nasty high shot. And you're thinking, it was late in the game, so they didn't get a chance to replace him, but you're thinking, how can someone come on after that? Fingers crossed we don't see any instances of that.
Yeah, it's interesting your point about the big men getting a long run-up, and how it can almost seem unseemly in a way, those collisions. And you look to the NFL, for example, which you should almost never do if you're searching for some kind of moral guidance, but in this instance they did move their kickoff further up the pitch so that most kickoffs would basically go out of the end zone and you'd be starting from the 20 meter line. Basically you'd restart play with the receiving team having the ball. They were almost looking to reduce the number of runbacks because of it's, you know, it's along with punts, it's the only instance in a game really where a player is receiving a ball way down the pitch and is then sprinting at full speed into a head-on collision with a defensive team who were sprinting at full speed as well. And it that alone was resulting in a lot of concussions, head injuries. So they reduced it by basically reducing the number of kickoffs that can be run back or are likely to be run back. So
that's fascinating.
It's one for rugby to keep an eye on, genuinely.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I wasn't aware of that. But yeah, it'll be worth keeping an eye on. And at the same time, some people love seeing those kind of big collisions. And if there's no head injury, people do enjoy those at times as well. It's a spectacle. It's just a little bit dangerous, potentially. You do get attacking possession immediately, flooding back of the defense, which is what they're looking for here. You know, less kind of hanging around, you're not kind of further down the field than a 22 meter restart, and you can put pressure on again. So it'll be interesting to track them all, and you need multiple games to get a sense of what they're all about. I think everyone will be studying the terms and conditions on the captain's challenge in the meantime.
100%. One quick one before we wrap, your early week impressions ahead of La Rochelle, Leinster, which way are you leaning at the moment? Do you anticipate that it might change as we approach Thursday, when we'll be discussing the game in a little bit of more detail?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting into that on Thursday. I got an email from Kevin Finley, it was, just asking us to give it a good in-depth preview. His impression is that because Leinster are so good, maybe sometimes they don't get the in-depth stuff, but I can assure him we'll get stuck in. I'm probably leaning towards Leinster at this early stage. I have been watching a fair bit of La Rochelle over the last while, just kind of catching up on what they do and how they play. And it's so exciting because they've never played each other, the two of them. It's such a fresh kind of European tie, isn't it? And La Rochelle have been a breath of fresh air in that regard. And they play really outstanding balanced rugby. Someone like Will Skelton, if you're talking about collisions, he's the boss of it in Europe at the moment, with a lovely skill set on the other side. He can offload to the likes of Victor Vito and Gordon, who can offload themselves and are equally powerful. Weenie Antonio on the front row are really muscular, obviously, and they're big. They're big, and Leinster have had issues with really big packs like Saracens in the past. So they'll look to those examples for confidence. La Rochelle, Interesting to see what happens with the out halves in terms of injury on both sides of the game and the half backs indeed. But they've got a nice kick passing game. They've got variety to that kicking. They can move the ball to Doolan, who's got a lovely left boot and has assisted tries. People like Raymond Rule are so dangerous out wide for them. So there's a lovely variety to how they play, and they'll definitely ask questions, I think, of Leinster. But having watched that Exeter game back another time, I'm just thinking, well, when Leinster get on top, and even if it's without someone like Johnny Sexton, they are close to unstoppable when they really click. So I'm veering towards them. What are you thinking?
I'm leaning towards Leinster as well. I want Leinster to win, kind of. I wouldn't be a massive Leinster fan, even when they're, like, you know, what I'm basically saying is I'm a Munster fan first and foremost, and beyond that, I don't care that much. I generally like to see the Irish provinces do well, but here you've got an Irish connection in Rog as well, which probably makes me more connected to La Rochelle, Darren Sweetnam also, than I am to Leinster in a way, you know. So I'm hoping for a good game first and foremost. I think the idea of La Rochelle knocking Leinster off at this stage of their journey, if you like, just as they kind of emerge as a European force, puts them on the map majorly and could be the type of signature victory that sees them hang around for years to come, like really establishes them. But when I look at the way Leinster put Exeter away, I can't really lean any other way in terms of predicting the game than lean towards Leinster. Just want to let's elaborate a little bit on Kevin's point there about the fact that maybe because Leinster is so consistently excellent, they don't kind of get the same airtime as Munster. We probably do get suggestions from listeners and various detractors that we're too harsh on Munster at times, or that we spend too long speaking about Munster. When we talked about Leinster beating Munster a few weeks ago, I was quite pointed in saying I wanted to speak about Leinster first, because probably I felt the same way as Kevin at times. And yet we still got a comment or two saying, well, it actually just kind of reversed into Munster chat in the end anyway. I think, to be fair, like I actually think he has a point, but I don't think it's unnatural or it's nothing to do with bias or anything like that. I think the issue is that when a team has problems, we all have our potential solutions, you know, and it's just often a more interesting conversation in that you're able to opine as to where you think they're going wrong and how they might fix it. Whereas when a team is as well oiled and as good as Leinster, we just have to say they're good, but we can't make them. We can't suggest how they really will get better. You can, to be fair, and Bernard can, but there's less to add from our point of view, I think, often.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't really thought about it a huge amount. Like Munster, there's a lot of interest in Munster from outside Munster as well. You know what I mean? There's, like, even in terms of engaging with articles and stuff, I think Munster stories are the big stories, even still. Like, all Leinster fans, I think, are interested in Munster or giving out about them or talking them down. And again, that's part of the fun and games. Yeah, from our point of view, and I don't think Kevin was having a go at us in any way, and he just emailed me back. I just had a quick check, and he said, oh, you know, I'm talking about other people, but yeah, we've given them their dues. You're right. There's probably more kind of structural things around Munster that we've been talking about recently, definitely. Absolutely. But on the whole, I think I love watching Leinster games because there's always so much to learn from them. There's so many little details around it, so much clever thinking on the coaching point of view, the player's point of view. I got a chance to speak to Jack Conan last week and just asking about some of the set piece stuff. We had an article with him on Sunday, and, you know, it's clever, the thinking all the time. They've always come up with some different little solution for breaking down teams. And yeah, I can't wait to get stuck into actually analysing this match after the fact, as well as looking forward to, because you know there's going to be so many clever bits that even if they don't work out, there was clear, lucid kind of thinking behind them. So yeah, we'll keep analysing all four provinces. I hope we do that to a great enough degree. And, you know, I know I've always got messages from Connacht fans, from Ulster fans, from Leinster fans, from Munster fans, saying I'm biased or I don't focus on them enough. So everyone has their own kind of, I would say, viewpoint that's biased in some ways. So you probably always want more of your province. But we'll keep doing our best, Gav.
Yeah, listen, if you're biased against them all, then that just means you're doing your job, I think. Or biased towards them all equally. I'll let you go. Thanks a million, Murray.
Cheers, Gav. Looking forward to Thursday.
Yeah, me too. And thank you to all of the 42 members for your continued support, which makes podcasts like these possible. And thank you to Robin Dempsey for the big question on the women's game as well. We'll be back on Thursday with myself, Murray and Bernard. Until then, mind yourselves, take it easy.
I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
Leinster could offer me $5 million a year, I wouldn't go.
It is Johnny Moore!
Rugby weekly.
Little reverse pass. Oh! Oh!
Magic!
You're not alive, boys, so you start kicking when